Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. With the fast lane on a highway, higher speed limits enable you to reach your destination sooner. A new Federal Communications Commission rule unveiled last week would provide a fast lane on the internet for certain companies. The issue at stake is net neutrality, and joining just now to talk about that is Huffington Post tech reporter Jerry Smith. Welcome back to the show, Jerry.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You wrote that consumer advocates think that maybe the end of the internet as we know it is at hand. That's pretty dramatic. So before we get to the new proposal, can you explain what net neutrality is and how we got here?
Yeah, net neutrality is the idea that your internet provider, whether you have Comcast or Time Warner or Verizon or AT&T, your internet provider delivers all the web traffic equally and doesn't discriminate against certain websites, doesn't block certain sites or slow down certain sites. So this is really gets at the fundamental, you know, what the internet essentially is, which is that every website, all internet traffic should be treated equally and shouldn't, your internet provider shouldn't be determining which sites you can see and the quality of your internet experience.
Now, this isn't necessarily the FCC's idea. A court decision in January brought this about. What did it do that made the FCC change its rules?
Yeah, the court decision in January essentially said that the internet is not the same as like a telephone, for example. The telephone service is a utility, and therefore it's highly regulated. And the court said that internet service is not a utility, and it's not subject to the same sort of regulations. So this was a court case, a lawsuit that was filed by Verizon, and Verizon and other internet providers have said that they've spent a lot of money, billions of dollars, building broadband networks across the country, and that they should be able to basically charge a premium to certain internet provider or certain content creators who are delivering content. For example, Netflix does a lot of streaming videos now. Those videos carry a lot of data, and the internet providers will say that they're that's more and more data is congesting their networks, and so they should be charging these companies a premium to deliver all these videos to your home.
But by doing so, giving them more access to your home.
Right.
I mean, it's an advantage for them.
Right. The content, I mean, the essentially the rules that the FCC has proposed last week is saying that Netflix, for example, can pay your internet provider a premium to deliver that service to you faster. I mean, a lot of people are sort of using the analogy of an internet fast lane or a carpool lane. Opponents are saying that this goes against net neutrality, because the idea of net neutrality is everything should be created equally. And what they're also saying is that the average consumer may actually start paying more for Netflix or some of the other websites that they view, because those companies are going to have to essentially pass on the costs of paying their internet providers, pass on those costs to the consumer. And another thing that they're warning about is the idea that smaller startups may not be able to afford to pay the internet companies, the internet providers, to deliver this service, and they may not be able to pay for access to the fast lane. And therefore, some small startup that maybe you've never heard of, but maybe very promising and could be the next, YouTube or Twitter, may never actually happen, because a company like that might not be able in its early stages to afford to pay to get in that internet fast lane.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Jerry Smith, tech reporter with The Huffington Post, about new FCC rules that consumer advocates say could end the way the internet operates as we know it. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. What kind of difference in speed are we talking about here? Will the difference be noticeable, say, to people who stream Netflix a lot?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, right now the FCC has proposed new rules, and you know, one of the things that these new rules would say is that these, you know, Comcast or Verizon would have to be transparent about, you know, how they're treating all their internet traffic, how much faster certain traffic is than others, how much they're charging those companies to get in the internet fast lane. It's not really clear whether, you know, how much faster that would be, whether certain websites would load, you know, in 2 seconds and other websites would load in 5 seconds. You know, I think it's important to note that the FCC is saying you can't, these companies, these internet providers can't slow down any traffic, but they can cut deals that allow certain traffic to go faster. You know, you could argue that maybe a video, that might be the difference between some Netflix video you're watching buffering versus not buffering, or a YouTube video that buffers. And I know that's something that everyone, you know, unless you have an extremely fast internet account, everyone sort of it deals with an issue like video buffering. So, I mean, you could just, you know, the quality of the video, I think that's a big thing is watching video online that more and more people are doing. And I think that could potentially have a real effect on that.
So let's talk a little bit about the expense and expensive for who. The cost would go up to company, you know, sites like Netflix or Hulu or whatever. Are they for this change? Are those kind of sites for it, or because they'll just pass it on to the consumer, or what?
I think Netflix has come out and said that they're not in favor of this, but most companies have been sort of quiet about it so far. But yeah, I mean, the consumer groups that have been most vocal about it in the last week have said that, you know, this inevitably is going to lead to higher costs for the average consumer, because if, you know, Netflix or another website that you like going to, if they have to pay the internet provider for faster service, then eventually they're going to pass along those costs to you, the consumer.
Rich in Columbus, you're on the air with Jerry Smith from Huffington Post. Hi, Rich.
Hi, good morning. Good morning, Ann. I wanted to ask for Jerry's comment on something. I see a tremendous conflict of interest here. First of all, I know a lot of people who are either cutting their cable service or reducing it or just turning it off completely in favor of getting Hulu and Netflix or one or the other, or maybe even some of the other services provided. Now, consequently, these cable companies who are losing money are also the cable providers. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if this is a way to come out. It looks to me like it might be a way of just coming out and punishing a competitor. And I just wanted to hear your comment, Jerry.
Yeah, I mean, that's an excellent point, because these companies that are providing your internet service are also entertainment companies. For example, Comcast. Comcast is not only the nation's largest internet service provider and could potentially get even larger if they're allowed to take over Time Warner, but they also own NBC Universal, and there's a lot of you know, programming that NBC Universal creates. I mean, and there's even a very popular website, Hulu, that people watch a lot of NBC shows on. Mm-hmm. And the concern that some a lot of people, consumer advocates, will have is that an internet provider like Comcast could favor that content over a competitor's content, and say, you know, make Hulu's service on your computer go faster than another, you know, competing service. And the FCC has said that that is something that they're going to be keeping a close eye on, and that these you know, any kind of deals that the internet providers strike with content companies, that they're not favoring their own content over a competitor.
Thanks, Rich, for that call. Now, the FCC is saying that the new rules would not harm internet users. You referred to a blog post from FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler that said there's been a great deal of misinformation about the proposal. What does he mean by that? Who's been misinformed?
You know, I think what he's saying is when people talk about net neutrality, I think they talk about discrimination of certain websites. And I think the FCC will say that we're not allowing internet providers to slow down certain sites or block certain sites, but we are going to allow them to make certain sites go faster. And I think the question that people are sort of wondering is, you know, if you're allowing some sites to go faster, doesn't that mean those other sites that aren't paying up, don't they consequently go slower? So there's a little bit of confusion right now about exactly, I mean, there's a lot of legal experts are looking at this. The FCC is saying we would only allow these deals that are commercially reasonable, and commercially reasonable is in quotes. And I think a lot of people are trying to figure out what that means. I think there's still a long way to go here. I mean, this was rules that were proposed on Thursday, and then the FCC commissioners still have to vote on this. This is going to go out for public comment in May, and any kind of final decision on this is probably not going to be made until later this year, and therefore, you know, I think a lot of these questions that people have are probably going to be answered in the weeks to come.
Who's going to speak for the smaller companies, the startups that might be shut out of this faster lane in the future? Who speaks for them when they maybe don't even exist yet?
Yeah, I mean, that's an excellent question. I think that, there are there's going to be an enormous amount of lobbying in the coming weeks as the FCC sort of these rules take more shape and some of the details get filled in. And, some Silicon Valley companies and, you know, startups are part of sort of umbrella groups that are starting to lobby in Washington. But companies like Comcast especially have enormous lobbying operations in Washington. In fact, you know, some of the people, there's people who lobby for Comcast who've worked at the FCC before. So they have an enormous influence in Washington. Some could argue much more so than a small startup in Silicon Valley that's trying to become the next Skype or YouTube. So that is a good question, is who speaks for these people. The startups that are probably in their basement or in their garage somewhere still sort of dreaming up the next big thing. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be a lot of lobbying going on in the months to come in Washington, and it would appear as though the major internet providers like Comcast and Verizon would have an upper hand on that.
There's another topic that you brought up in your article that I think could affect a lot of people. Harold Feld, he's a senior VP at the consumer group Public Knowledge, and he brought up the issue of how it could also affect online education and access to online education. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is such a huge issue because it really affects everyone who has any stake in the internet. I thought that was kind of interesting. He was telling me about how if your kids go to school and they're getting an online education curriculum, oftentimes that curriculum is designed by a company, and maybe that company has cut a deal with Verizon to allow some of those online videos as part of that curriculum to stream faster than others. Well, if that student has Verizon at home, he can watch those videos or access that online curriculum without any problem. But if that student maybe has another internet provider that's not Verizon, maybe he isn't able to access those videos or do any of his homework online as quickly or as easily as one of his other students. And that gets sort of this notion of the digital divide where, mm-hmm. Students who go home and don't have computers or don't have a quick internet connection maybe are falling behind some of their peers. So, I mean, this is really, what Harold Feld said to me as well was that, you could potentially see people choosing their internet providers based on what sort of content they want to access and, deciding whether they want to sign up for Verizon, Fios, or Comcast based on what deals those companies have made with Netflix or whatever websites that they need to use on a regular basis.
Jerry Smith, thanks for joining us. This is an ongoing topic of conversation, and I hope we talk with you again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Jerry Smith, he's a tech reporter with the Huffington Post. Tech Tuesday continues. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. In our computer and technology dependent world, if it can be, it will be hacked. Even in hospitals, even with medical equipment, according to a recent study. Joining us today is senior staff reporter at Wired, covering cybercrime, privacy, and security, Kim Zetter. Welcome to the show, Kim.
Thank you.
Your recent article profiles one security expert who works for a healthcare provider in the Midwest. How did his investigation start, and what did he find?
Well, he works for Essentia Health, which operates about 100 facilities in Minnesota, North Dakota, Wisconsin, and Idaho. And they had a third-party security firm come in and do sort of what's called a penetration test of their network, which is basically just to see if there are vulnerabilities that would allow hackers onto the network. And they found some insecure devices that were connected to the network. And so Essentia Health started looking at also previous research that other experts had done on devices themselves, like insulin pumps and defibrillators, where they found insecurities in those devices. So Essentia basically tasked Scott Irvin and his team with basically looking at all of their equipment across all of their hospitals in every department to see what vulnerabilities they had.
So tell us what kind of benefit there would be to hacking medical equipment. Why the vulnerability aside, what's to gain from it?
Well, you can. In some cases, you can do a targeted attack. So, if you have a specific victim that you want to focus on, who, for instance, has a defibrillator, in the way that former Vice President Dick Cheney had a defibrillator, you can perform attacks that would administer an electric shock to their heart. Some of the other vulnerabilities that he found are less targeted, or they would take a lot more work to focus on a specific patient that you want to attack, but they are open to sort of random mayhem, either by hackers who just want to cause chaos, and they can change dosages delivered to patients, they can change medical records, just people who want to cause trouble. But also, if we're looking at an emergency situation, if there's been a terrorist attack, and you want to not only sort of attack streets or buildings, but you want to go after the emergency services facilities that are coming in the aftermath, this might be a way to sort of extend the effects that an attack might have.
How much of the equipment is vulnerable to this in any given hospital, typically?
Well, what they found was that most of the equipment has vulnerabilities. Many of the manufacturers have not secured the systems. Information about your healthcare, your records, are transmitted in the clear without encryption. They're stored without password protection. And so a lot of these devices either don't have password protection at all, or they have minimal password protection, like 1234, or just the word admin for a password. And although it's unclear exactly how many of these devices can be accessed directly from the Internet, let's say you pull up your browser and you can just find them through an IP address, it's unclear how many of those are directly connected. But you can get onto the hospital network, and then once you're in the hospital network, you can search for these devices and find them connected.
Well, that's why I'm wondering about how do they get, aren't the hospital networks more secure than that?
No, no network is very secure. I mean, everyone can get hacked, and you can hack workers through a phishing attack, which is just a malicious email, and then get on the network.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Right now we're talking about the vulnerability of our hospitals, and not just the networks of the hospitals, but the equipment they use. So much of it is dependent, well, all of it almost is dependent on computers and so forth. If you have a question or comment for my guest, Kim Zetter at Wired, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Kim, this sounds kind of terrifying when you're talking about it. Is this the first time that anyone's thought about this before?
No. Okay. You know, there are a lot of security researchers that have been trying to get attention for this, but they've only been able to do it in bits and pieces. They find one piece of equipment that's vulnerable, and then a story might get written about that, or an advisory might get issued from the government, or a patch might be issued from the vendor. But it's been piecemeal, and so it's been hard for people to get a grasp of how widespread the problem is. So while there have been a lot of people trying to get attention for this over the years, I think this is the first time where we really have a comprehensive look. I mean, it's sort of unprecedented that a hospital would basically open all of their systems to a security researcher and basically say, have at it.
And does this change, or could it change, not just the technology itself, but also hospital policy? I'm thinking about, are there any fail-safes that they're thinking about to make sure that the dosages aren't being changed and that sort of thing, to double-check?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, there's there are things that the makers of the equipment need to do to secure them, but there are also a lot of things that the hospitals need to do. And one of those things is, you know, having manual overrides when they do discover a problem, as you point out, that you can sort of disconnect the internet access or the remote access and take over the equipment yourself. But there are other things that, you know, you don't have to give everyone in the hospital access to these devices, and you can wall off the devices so that only they're only available at certain times or by specific people with the, good authorization to get into the systems.
Have there been any instances that anyone knows of equipment being hacked yet?
Well, this is the interesting thing, is that we might not know what the cause was. So something can go wrong, and it can be a lot of reasons. It can be human error with a nurse or a doctor. It can be also just a natural failure of equipment, or it can be someone getting in and modifying, and we wouldn't know. It's very difficult to detect some kind of malicious activity on these systems. We know that there have been examples of hackers getting onto hospital networks, where they've posted a video online showing that they got into the hospital network, but not necessarily doing anything with the equipment. So it's well known that the systems are vulnerable, that the networks are vulnerable, and that people can get into them.
They're talking about taking medical records, and that there's a huge movement afoot now to computerize everything.
Yes, I've been concerned about this for a while. The federal government has pushed this. They want all medical records digitized. Doctors and hospitals have pushed this because they think that it'll save them money paper-wise. Mm-hmm. But again, in all of these situations, every time this happens, the victims in this, of course, are the consumers, the health, the patients, whose data is not going to be secured. The federal government has assured everyone, and there's HIPAA regulations, that this data is going to be secure, but we know it's not going to be. And there are huge problems with digitizing all of the medical records in this way.
Now, are there makers of equipment that are more vulnerable than others? Are there makers of equipment that have foreseen this possibility and have been working on it?
Yeah, there are some systems that are better secured than others. There are some systems that are using encryption. One of the things that Scott and his team found, though, was that there was a vendor that is used by many hospitals for transmitting data from medical devices directly into your medical record. So if you've got a defibrillator, if you've got other equipment, ventilators, things at the hospitals that are working on a patient, that data is all being transmitted automatically without human intervention directly into the medical record. And the doctors and nurses are relying on the information in those medical records to be accurate. And what they found was that transmission of data is not encrypted and it's not authenticated in any way. So anyone on the network can actually intercept that data and redirect it to other medical records or change the data. So you could have cases of someone basically just randomly wanting to do mayhem and distributing information into medical records where it doesn't belong.
And you mentioned terrorist attacks, the impact, that it could be coming from that sector. Is Homeland Security interested in this at all?
They have been involved, on a piece-by-piece basis. As security researchers have found problems with individual devices, they've contacted. There's a division of Department of Homeland Security called ICS CERT, which is stands for Industrial Control System Commuter Emergency Response Team. And they handle a lot of these vulnerabilities, mediating between the researcher and the vendor to try and get some of these things fixed. But there's only so much they can do. I mean, in the end, it really is on the onus of the vendor to fix these things and be honest also with customers that when they create a patch or when there's a problem with their system, that they notify the customers, and so the hospitals and the doctors know that they need to do something to the system to secure it.
Is there any sense about what this can do to the cost of healthcare in this country?
Well, you know, this shouldn't increase the cost of healthcare. I mean, vendors, you know, they should be securing these systems. That should be part of the price of the equipment that they, when they sell it to hospitals. Again, this is the problem of vendors not thinking this through, not considering security. And also, the FDA doesn't require a security assessment of equipment before it goes on the market. So perhaps there's something that the FDA can do that adds that as a requirement before equipment like this can be sold.
But in the meantime, there is a lot of stuff out there that could be hacked right now.
Yes, and I think that it's part the duty of hospitals and doctors to make strong inquiries to their vendors and demand, that these systems get fixed, and also to, get some third-party assessments in the way the Essentia Health did in having Scott Irvin and his team look at these systems.
And then also people who are in big healthcare systems that they can access their records online now, that's like at OSU, they can do that now. Is that worth doing, or do you make yourself more vulnerable until they work these issues out?
You definitely make yourself vulnerable, not only because the hospital systems are not necessarily secure, but your own system is not necessarily secure. You might have hackers already on your personal computer, and when you log in to get your health record, they can get your health record as well. And there's a lot more that someone can do with a health record, than just if you're filling your credit card number. If they're getting your health records and your insurance information, they can basically get drug prescriptions as you. We've seen a lot of Medicare theft and insurance theft in this way of people going to hospitals and getting care as someone else.
Well, I was going to ask about prescription drug abuse and whether that would, there's a huge market for it, of course. There's got money to be made.
Yes, there's a huge money, a lot of money to be made. And not just in that, but just in general insurance fraud.
By manipulating the records?
Not by manipulating the records, but by basically taking over someone's account and getting medical care under your account.
The hacker group Anonymous recently targeted Boston Children's Hospital. What did they do?
In that case, I'm not familiar with that. I saw a headline, but I'm not sure what they did. I think they just they obtained customer records, the patient records. Was that?
Uh huh. Okay. Yeah. I wasn't sure either. I was. But just getting records is that. I mean, Anonymous likes to point out vulnerabilities. That's one of the things they like to do. Are there any other examples of, do you know of anything like that happening out there where there's hacker hacktivists trying to show people what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, this is a long tradition in the hacking community. It's been this way for a couple of decades. They'll find vulnerabilities and they'll publicize them to shame companies that they lack security and try and get things fixed. Sometimes it's for altruistic reasons. You know, they really do want to get things fixed. And sometimes it's, a bit of a power trip to show that they can get into a system. But it does serve a purpose. However, the methods may be questionable. It does force people to take a better look at security, and many times companies and hospitals, they're not going to address it until something like this happens.
Mort in Westerville, you're on the air. Welcome. Hello, Mort. Hello, Mort. Are you there? Okay. Well, I want to thank you, Kim Zetter, for joining us today. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Kim Zetter, she's a senior staff reporter at Wired, covering cybercrime, privacy, and security. Tech Tuesday continues. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. A few weeks ago, we talked about it. We talked about it a few weeks later. Microsoft dropped support for its Windows XP operating system, but recently a security flaw in Internet Explorer browser was discovered, and yesterday the Department of Homeland Security issued a warning not to use the browser until the flaw is fixed. But those still clinging to Windows XP may be out of luck. Joining us now to discuss that and other tech news is tech blogger for Geek.com, Russell Holley. Welcome back to the show, Russell.
Hey, thanks.
So you told me a couple weeks ago you don't want to talk about Windows XP anymore, but here we go again.
I really don't, yeah. the reason that I wanted to bring it up here was because there was someone who called in the last time we talked about it who asked how long it was going to be before Windows XP had a vulnerability that was a real problem, and I said that it probably wouldn't be a while, and I was obviously pretty wrong. This is all versions of Internet Explorer from Internet Explorer 11 all the way back to Internet Explorer 6 are vulnerable to this exploit, which is basically a special flash file that can compromise Internet Explorer and make it so that whoever's trying to attack can really do some nasty stuff to your computer. The simple way to bypass this is to not use Internet Explorer, and Windows XP still has support for some support for Chrome and Firefox and things like that. So there all are alternative browsers that you can install and have it not be as big a problem. But if you've already been affected by it, it may not be something that antivirus can pick up or something that could be exploited 6 months from now, depending on what kind of access they have to your machine.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Still with me is Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. If you have a random tech question for Russell Holley, you're welcome to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Just about anything you want to talk about. So far, I think Russell's only been stumped a couple times. They're constantly releasing updates to programs like Internet Explorer. Is this so? And you said this flaw is
releasing updates to modern versions of Internet Explorer. It's important to keep in mind that, you know, if you're running an older version of Internet Explorer, you're not going to get those updates. And because Windows XP has been officially kind of set aside by Microsoft, it's not something that's going to receive priority anyway. So even if Microsoft looked at this and said, okay, this is something that we can fix inside of Windows XP, There are several different versions of the Internet Explorer browser that still are used on many different computer systems, both in businesses and at home, and each one of them is vulnerable.
So what it comes down to is if you're still using XP, stop.
Stop.
Once again.
If you can't stop right this second, then get a different browser until you can stop.
Why do you think people cling to it?
Because it's, you know, for starters, it's what they already have. And I mean, if they're only using the computer for a couple of things and it's not worth the upgrade, then it doesn't end up being a big deal. But the other thing is that, you know, there's a general, you know, dislike of the massive visual overhaul in Windows 8, especially when, you know, you've been using something that is as familiar looking as Windows XP for the last 10 years. So it's definitely understandable, but we should probably get over it.
You know, just in general, Russell, how often should people expect change in technology like this? I mean, quit clinging and just start expecting it? How often?
Well, it's not an easy question to answer because you have, you have basic changes, really simple changes that happen every couple of months, depending on what software you're using. It's not often that we have massive visual overhauls that change the core of how things get used when you deal with things like operating systems or email clients or things like that. A lot of that stays relatively the same because it's a format that works. And so features kind of get added around it and tweaks happen. Microsoft kind of, you know, pulled the Band-Aid off and made huge, huge changes all at once. And that was definitely, they're far from the only company to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say, you know, once every couple of years, you should expect a big visual change, just because that's the pace of design changing along with all of those functions that are being added on.
Tim in Columbus, you're on the air with Russell Holly. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Anne. Hi, Russell. Hey, so my name's Tim, and I am an IT director at a Columbus school. And one of the things that we say about ourselves is that we are a jack of all trades and expert of none. And so we have about 400 iPads and about 30 PCs that are running Windows 7. But one of the things that you brought up about XP is interesting is I have a couple XP machines and a couple older staff members who are diehard on XP and are not, they're dragging their feet. They're not ready to move. And so it's kind of interesting to think about how we're going to support XP and as well as move away from Internet Explorer is something that's been difficult. So it's interesting. I don't know if you have a comment or a thought on someone in my position who supports so many different platforms and so many different devices and trying to work with individuals who are set in their ways, and we're trying to move one direction. So I'd just be curious what your thoughts are, Russell.
I think eventually you're going to reach a point where, you know, their comfort level is going to be less important than the security of your network. And that's going to be a decision that's going to have to be made, when that happens. It needs to be explained that these vulnerabilities, while it's not a guarantee that you're going to be infected, the difference here between, you know, a random piece of malware or, something that constantly spawns pop-up ads, is that any kind of malicious code can be activated remotely from this particular exploit. So you go to a website and a flash ad pops up and you close it, the vulnerability has already happened. The person who deployed that has already gained access to the computer. So it's not something as simple as a pop-up ad or a tracking cookie or something like that. This is an actual real thing that you should be concerned about for your entire network, not just that one user.
We were just talking about hospital security. What could be more important than school security?
Right. And I mean, that's the kind of thing I would honestly, ask them if they would prefer to do all of their work on nothing but an iPad until they get over it.
Okay.
That's a good point. another question, specifically when you're talking about network security, if that device doesn't have admin access, in terms of like if the user that's logged in that accesses it, if it's just a local user that's completely restricted, are they going to be able to get around that into admin access? I guess it's more a specific tech question.
That's okay.
That's definitely an exploit that is well documented in Windows XP, is granting administrator access even though the profile itself doesn't have it. That's something that has been patched several different times for Microsoft because vulnerabilities keep being found. I don't know of one that is presently active, but that certainly doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. It's been a while since I've really dug into Windows XP security, but that is certainly a problem that has happened in the past that has caused the exact issue that you're describing. Is the user didn't have admin access, but the vulnerability granted it anyway.
All right, Tim, thanks a lot for that call. Pam in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Pam.
Hi. I had a question. You guys, I believe it was the middle of last year, had mentioned a new phone that was more on the lines of a handheld computer as opposed to just a quote-unquote smartphone. And your expected time of release was going to be like May or June of this year. And I cannot remember the name of the phone.
Russell, you know I can't.
if you're looking, that sounds like something I would have used to describe more along the lines of the Samsung Galaxy Note line,
okay.
Which allowed for multiple window support and kind of greater than just single screen functionality. But there was also the Ubuntu phone that we talked about that hasn't been released yet, that was supposed to allow you to have like a full Linux desktop when you plugged into your mouse and keyboard. But again, that's not something that has actually come to happen yet.
Okay. All right. Good luck, Pam, with that. And Georgia. Hi, Georgia. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, good morning. I'm one of those old fogies that has an old computer that I cannot afford to replace. So how can I tell if it is capable of handling a newer operating system? It's probably about a 10 or 12-year-old Dell And if you have any suggestions how I can make it less vulnerable, I would be glad to switch. I just don't know what to do.
So there are two things that you can do. One is a lot more complicated than the other, so I'll try and give you the simple one first.
Thank you.
Microsoft has a tool on their website. If you just go to Microsoft.com and click on the Windows button, it will let you know. It will run a scan of your computer and let you know what Microsoft products are available for you to upgrade to, without, you know, that are supported, so that you'll be able to upgrade to something that won't, you know, completely slow down your machine and destroy it. If you have access to someone who knows how, there is also what's called a live USB installer for other versions of Windows or even for Linux that will allow you to take what's basically a USB stick and plug it into your computer and run that operating system on your computer without touching any of your files, to give you a better feel of how that would run on your machine initially.
Thank you.
Yep. Georgia, thanks for the call. Frank in Columbus, you're on the air with Russell Holly. Hi, Frank.
Hey, Dan. Hey, I just wanted to talk about the way the XP update kind of left our company in the lurch, because we work with building automation systems, and a lot of these systems that are running, like the building in Columbus, are like 30 years old, and the tools that you use to actually program them don't have a Windows 7 or a Windows 8 version. So we have to have machines that don't work on Windows, like they have to have XP on them. It's not just something where we're just like stuck in our ways or the visual update or anything like that. This is actual legacy hardware that we need this stuff for.
Well, I mean, there's two realistic solutions to that particular problem, depending on what exactly the application is running. The first is legacy run modes that are supported in both Windows 7 and Windows 8 that will, for lack of a better simple explanation, emulate the run time for Windows XP so that that program will run in the newer versions of Windows. But you should also consider virtual machines that can be run on, you know, significantly less hardware and using it just to run those programs, not using Windows XP to do things like surf the web or do anything like that. You can still have Windows 8 and then run Windows XP in a virtual machine to handle those applications.
Okay, Frank? No, go ahead.
We do actually have virtual machines running on the places where we can do that, but there's something like there's a Pick'em'Sia card, like this little hardware card that you have to put in the slot where it's just the actual hardware driver for it that doesn't go through the virtualization layer there for, I mean, I guess I'm getting a little nerdy there, but.
No, it's over my head, but Russell, well, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, for PCMCIA hardware, it really depends on how the virtualization is done, what application you're using, because there are some virtualization tools that will give you an entire host emulator that'll allow that to happen. And again, we're getting really, really technical here.
Yes.
But, there are some virtualization tools that will allow you to take advantage of, you know, kind of that ad hoc hardware that you're dealing with. But, you know, not having experienced it myself, I can't say that one would be a guaranteed solution for you.
Good luck, Frank. And Barry in Columbus, welcome. Sounds like you're sick, Barry.
Now what happened was I stupidly clicked on one of them pop-up windows telling me my Java needed upgraded, and I got some virus that totally messed up my Windows Defender and Windows Firewall. And I found a way to fix the Defender, although it was, I think it had something to do with the registry, I don't remember, but... the Windows Firewall, I have not been able to get it fixed or get it to reload. What do you suggest?
The problem with doing work on machines that are already infected is that it becomes difficult to make sure that the infection isn't, you know, deceiving the scanning software into thinking that it's not malicious. So I would try, if you have... something other than Windows Defender, to install and run to see if it can detect it.
I managed to find it and got rid of it. I've got three other software, Avast and Malwarebyte, I forget what it's called, and then something else. So it's not there anymore. It's something. There's a problem. I went on a forum and they gave information about how to fix these things, but it only was able to fix Defender and not Firewall, Windows version, that is.
It's entirely possible that in the process of trying to eliminate the virus, that certain files were quarantined, like maybe registry files, and that may be causing the problem that you're experiencing. There's not like a one button solution to that particular problem, unfortunately.
All right, Barry, good luck. It sounds like we're in a hospital. Jeremy from Columbus asks, why is this bug in Internet Explorer not considered to be a bug in Adobe Flash? After all, it requires Flash in order to be exploited. Does that
make
sense?
It's how this browser executes Flash commands, which is different from how the other browsers execute those Flash commands. That's the reason that if it was an Adobe problem, it would happen. It would affect all browsers equally, as far as how they handled Flash. But this is specifically how Internet Explorer deals with Flash.
Can you believe we've been talking about this for so long?
I'm a little in shock. But
okay, let's talk about the Google Maps Street View time travel. We know that Google is working on bringing driverless car to the roads, but now they're offering up time travel as well.
Sort of. Yeah, this was actually really cool. We've had Street View cars traveling around the world for so long that a lot of places that are kind of fun to visit or just kind of interesting to explore have been photographed so many times by these cars that you can actually go back in time and see the demonstration that Google gave was a building being built over time because the Street View car had passed around it so many times that it was able to basically photograph the entire build experience for that building.
And the Street View feature, once again, for Google Maps, that's when you see an actual photograph of something.
Right, yes. This is from the ground, you can click and pan around and see a 360-degree view of that spot on the map.
Are some places more apt to have these time travel opportunities than others?
Sure. I mean, the biggest thing you're looking for are places where Google Street View cars have been more than other places.
Mm-hmm.
So the example that was given was Freedom Tower in New York or the World Cup Stadium in Brazil. These are kind of key landmarks where, because streets have been changing and buildings have been added, the Street View cars have been there more than just once or twice. Whereas, for example, my street, the street that I live on, the Street View car has only ever been there twice. So when I went to use the time machine, there was only two pictures there, so it wasn't particularly interesting. But if you go to like the Freedom Tower in New York, there's 10 different photos from 2007 to 2013 that you can see as it's being built. And it's really cool to be able to go through and do that.
So you can just go to Google Map, and how do you get to it?
You just go to Google Maps, and Street View is the furthest level down. So you pick a point, you zoom in all the way down, and there's a little person that will show up, and you click on him, and it'll take you to the Street View. And if you have a place that has the time machine feature available, then there will be a little clock that you can click on and a window will open and allow you to go through and take a look.
Okay, we just have about 30 seconds, Russell. This is an email from Sarah. She says, I'm due for an upgrade for my iPhone 4S, but I'm thinking about waiting until the next iPhone comes out instead of getting a 5 now. How long will I have to wait for the next iPhone?
On the other side of summer, Apple has a pretty standard release cycle, and the fall will be when we will know more about the next iPhone.
All right, Russell Holly, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
It's Russell Holly. He's a tech blogger for Geek.com. You can hear him every week on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for listening.